Living in this zone and this band on this retreat, this remarkable process that we have of finding ourselves and coming home to ourselves in some way. So I thought tonight I would talk about this quality called Dhamma Vikaya, investigation. And I would talk about it in the framework of the practice meetings that we have with each other, that we share, you share with your teachers. And I think it might be useful to you and illuminating to get the ideas about really what the purpose of those meetings are and how they can best be utilized. What we're shooting for when we meet you, and how we hold the framework, how we can understand it. So I remember at one point there was a discussion amongst a group of teachers. This was ways back. I think I might have been assisting teacher then. And the question was, well, what should you call these get-togethers that you have with students in the course of a retreat? You know, and I don't know, some people who are from the left coast or the west coast, I can remember they had particular ideas, you know, like, you know, it could be, you know, dialogues or, you know, and then the east coasters, you know, were a little bit more structured. No, it's interviews. And then we talked about and thought, well, you know, that word interview, it's got certain resonances to it, right? And maybe it can generate some feelings associated with situations that can be stressful, like, you know, an interview for a job or a audition for a part as an actor or musician or, you know, exams to get into a school or being screened by border security or, you know, being cross-examined in court. Now, if one took up those resonances and brought them into the practice meeting room, you know, it makes it a little tighter than it needed to be. So that was one of the reasons that it got renamed Practice Meetings. Meetings. And yet still, there can be some feelings there about going into these practice meetings that could be a little bit like, you know, going to see a therapist or going to confession to a priest, you know, especially if you've broken the rules and been naughty. And you're afraid somebody saw you, and then you decide to bring it forward. Or, you know, talking to a confidant, you know, going to the dentist, something like that. So it might feel a little uncomfortable and awkward for those kinds of reasons. But actually, these practice meetings are something else. So you say, well, what actually is this? So they're actually a two-person joint Dharma inquiry, meaning their main purpose is what's called investigation, Dhamma Vikaya. So the teacher and the yogi do this practice together, sharing experience and perspective. So let's talk about what investigation is. Those of you who know the seven factors of awakening, do you know what those are? Some of you do, some of you don't, some of you know four out of seven, which I must tell you is not yet a passing grade. And there'll be a whole talk on the seven factors of awakening, but basically what they are is these are very wholesome qualities of mind that are developed in the course of Dharma practice and study, and in particular in meditation, one tending to lead to the next. that come together and strengthen and balance and actually lead us to liberation. So the first of these is mindfulness, right? Sati. So in the morning, you're getting instructions about mindfulness and how to do mindful meditation practice. And mindfulness is always the lead horse in any of this. It's the foundation for the rest of these factors to develop and open. So then there's mindfulness, and what does mindfulness do? Well, it does a lot of different things. But for our purposes today, we could say that the function of mindfulness is to investigate. To investigate. To look into the experience that we're having in real time. So mindfulness allows us to be present with experience without the mind being too filled with the hindrances, if mindfulness is strong. Then with mindfulness present, we can actually start to notice what we're experiencing in real time in an increasingly consistent way. So we get on the mindfulness train and we stay on it, and as we're with our experiences in real time, we start to notice certain things. And when the mind is inclined towards noticing certain things, when its experience in real time starts to be illuminated and visible to us, investigation is there and is looking at what is being experienced in a particular interested kind of way. So when mindfulness is there, then the yogi starts to notice things. And the yogi starts to become curious about what is happening, and starts to see the workings of the heart mind in real time as it happens. And from this process of connecting with experience, noticing it in real time, sustaining that noticing, we start to be able to see how suffering is created and how it can be let go. Right there in real time, with the experiences that are arising at the six sense doors. So we start seeing our own experience. It becomes illuminated. So this quality of investigation is sometimes called investigation of states or discerning the Dharma. So following investigation, we see in the unfolding of the seven factors energy. And why is that? It's because when the mind gets really interested in what it's experiencing in real time, from moment to moment, you don't have to push it so much to pay attention. It gets curious, it gets interested all on its own, and that brings forward energy to continue to notice. So this investigation is important. And it's one of the hallmarks of Buddhist practice. So there are many different spiritual traditions, of course. I just mentioned the Celts and I mentioned the Catholics, but, you know, there are all other different kinds of schools of spiritual practice. And one of the hallmarks of the Buddha's way is an emphasis on investigation. It's a highly valued quality in the system of practice and understanding. So if you know the Buddha's sermon to the Kalamas, where he was asked by a group of people who belonged to a particular tribe, who had a lot of different spiritual practitioners come into their community and tell them different things, and they asked him, well, how do you know? How do you know what's true? And I'm hearing this, I'm hearing that, I'm hearing this, I'm hearing that. And he said a number of things, but one of the things he emphasized was, look into it. Look into it and test it in your own experience. You don't need to just base your faith or base your understanding on somebody else's word, on someone else's representation, on something you read in a book, and something that you heard about, something that was handed down to you from your parents or your community. Look into it for yourself. Check it out. Test it. So this quality of investigation, of looking into our own experience, of checking and seeing if the truth claims of the Buddha stand up, is very much a part of this. So you could say this Dhammavichara, this investigation, is the wisdom factor waking up in the mind and starting to open in understanding. So wisdom results from correctly directed, mindful investigation. And it is wisdom that ultimately leads us to liberation. That's the understanding of this tradition. It's wisdom that liberates the mind. And I'll say a little bit more about the particulars of wisdom in this tradition in a bit, but one generic comment to make about it, about what wisdom is, when you talk about somebody being wise, you know, somebody might come to mind, you know, a historical figure, maybe somebody you know, or somebody who's been a mentor or teacher to you. When I think about who I would label wise, I tend to think of older people. Why? Well, because I am one. No, but what? Why? I mean, my mind goes in that direction. I think because it has something to do with experience and having seen a lot of things and coming to understand how things relate to each other. Right? What the facts of a situation might be, but also the implication of what is being observed, how things intersect, how they work together. And that's something, if one pays attention, can accumulate over the course of a lifetime. So it's not just, you know, pulling something out of your back pocket and saying, I know this, or, you know, just spouting off at the mouth. It's based on something real, something tangible, something that the person has learned through close observation and the noticing of cause and effect. What leads to what? So, Dhammavichara is the wisdom factor waking up in the mind. And this is what will lead to liberation. And from investigation, which happens in real time, this is happening in real time, right? It's not like us sitting down and speculating and trying to think it through out there. Oh, I read this one thing, and then I read this other thing, and I wonder if this is like that or if that's like that. No, here we're practicing here and now. What is it? What is known right now? What is noticed about what is known right now? So we come to know the states and attitudes of mind which are present. And we start to notice both what's skillful and what's unskillful. So there was a mention, I think the first night, about first step on the Eightfold Path, which is wise view, right? And Bhante, I believe, was talking about this, and he talked about mundane wise view. Didn't talk about it very long, but he hit it more later. And the idea behind this teaching, or the insight of this teaching, is that certain kinds of states, attitudes of mind, actions are born from greed, aversion, and delusion, and certain kinds of states, actions, intentions are born from generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom. And depending on what train you, car you get on, you're going in different directions. Right? And there's a reiteration of that distinction between wholesome and unwholesome, as I spoke about in my last talk, which was on wise intention. Right? That the intention to cultivate, renunciation to cultivate, loving kindness and compassion, that these are the compass for these practices. So this is what we're developing, and this is what we want more of, and we want more of it because, as we understand from the first step on the Eightfold Path, Wise View, they go, what we cultivate grows. What we relate wisely to with mindfulness grows and strengthens if it's wholesome. And if it's unwholesome, but we relate to it mindfully, we undercut that tendency of mind. We actually mitigate it and weaken it over time. So you see the power of mindfulness, which in that it is got the perfect pH, both to promulgate what is wholesome and to mitigate what's unwholesome. And you know by watching your own experience in the mind stream, you have both kinds of experiences arising, right? Wholesome and unwholesome, as well as some things that are they're more neutral seeming, right? Have you noticed? You have wholesome things arise. You have intention to let go. You have metta. You have compassion. You have renunciation. You have patience. You have determination and resolve. You have, you know, a lot of different wholesome things that can come up in the mind, many of which we don't see because they're not problematic. And we have other kinds of things come up in the mind, right? What would those be? The hindrances and offshoots of the hindrances, right? Craving, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt, and all their different flavors. You know, pain in the body, pain in the mind. Pain is not necessarily wholesome or unwholesome, right? It's just unpleasant. It's what the mind does in relationship to what is known that makes it wholesome or unwholesome. Our mind wholesome or unwholesome. But you get both, right? You get the blend, the human blend. So, you know, if we had our way, of course, we would get rid of all the unpleasant sensory experiences and all the difficult mind states. Have you tried it? Yes. Some of you are nodding yes. Okay, that's honest. Would you like it? Yes. Yeah, it would be great. Can we get it? We can. We can? Okay. You're coming up here later and giving the talk. So this does not seem to be a realistic possibility in the short term. So certainly difficult or painful or unpleasant experiences of the body are something that we have. It's like you got a body, you're going to have these kinds of experiences, right? You can train the mind to learn to relate to physical pain or distress or difficulty with wisdom and compassion, in which case you don't experience what's called the second arrow. You don't experience the mind like doubling down on its suffering now psychologically by how it talks to itself or how it relates to what's painful. What do I mean by that? Oh, God. My knee hurts. Uh-oh. If my knees keep going like this, I'm never going to be able to last this retreat. It's ruining it. I got to get rid of it. Right? And then the mind, right? Picking it up. The theme. Got to get rid of the pain. Got to get rid of the pain. Got to get rid of the pain. Got to fix the knee. Got to fix the knee. Got to fix the body. Got to figure out how it's not going to happen anymore. You know, and a certain amount of this is just, you know, regular human problem solving. That's got some intelligence in it, right? Well, yeah, you don't want to rack your knees. And then what about the situations where it's kind of like baked into the cake? That's the way it is, you know? For now, anyway. Some kind of unease in the body, you know? Stomach feels kind of queasy. It's like, Or I feel tired. You know, I gotta not feel tired. I gotta, you know, if I feel tired, it's really, I'm gonna fall asleep. And if I fall asleep, the whole retreat's wasted. So wise and unwise relationship to states that are present, states of the body, states of the mind. We're training the mind to find wise relationship to what we experience, no matter what it is, to our subjective arising experience, no matter what it is. Now, the paradox of this whole thing is it's through wise relationship and training the mind to be completely open to what it's experiencing in real time with some kind of balance and wisdom that the wisdom and all the wholesome qualities of the mind further develop, and the mind moves towards liberation. How interesting, huh? It's not through finding the selectomatic and being able to, you know, set it the way we want it to be. It's through learning how to do this. Has anybody ever practiced or seen the martial art of Aikido? Some of you? Some karatekas? So this is a very interesting martial art because, you know what, you know, the different forms of martial arts, for instance, like karate, you know, very linear. You know, punch, punch, kick, kick. You know, yeah, you block, but mostly you're trying to get them. And then there's Aikido, which is another way of working with the body and the energies, where the emphasis is actually on not so much on like the yang of going for them with aggression, but it's more a kind of sensitivity and flexibility of mind and body that focuses on noticing how the opponent is and how they're moving, and actually being so present to what's going on with them that one can blend and redirect. So some of you who have seen this will know, for instance, there are some videos of the founder of this system being attacked by multiple opponents who are coming at him from different ways. And in turn, he would just like, they'd be coming with the punches and the kicks, and he would just like grab somebody's punch, and instead of trying to do something, take the energy of the punch itself and use it to further draw the person in a way that, you know, toppled them without hurting them. So in our own practice, we learn to bring some of these principles of connecting so closely with what we're experiencing that the mind doesn't suffer through resistance to what's happening. And getting so close to what we're experiencing, so close to what we're experiencing, that we're not oppositional to what must be there in real time, given the totality of the circumstances. So this quality of investigation, which is supported by mindfulness, fueled by mindfulness, actually supports us in getting interested in the specifics, in the immediate specifics. What is present now? How is it? Both physical sensations that might be predominant, but also mind states that are there. So, part of what we see in the process of doing this, even though this isn't held out as like the point of it, but part of what we do see is our own personal patterns of suffering, right? Have you noticed certain tendencies of mind you might have? Right? So I'll just name a few that are pretty common, like command and control, you know, like I gotta get on top of this, you know. I gotta get on top of this situation, you know. Or there's the, you know, collapse into hopelessness, you know. I can't do it, you know. Where you're talking to yourself in certain kinds of ways, where you're kind of cheerleading on and fueling your own sense of incompetency. Or then there's like the competitive mind too. It's like, that guy thinks he can walk slow. Watch me, baby. Oh, you're not supposed to be watching me, but I do hope you notice. Or just like the, you know, yeah, all the different ways we talk to each other. I'm never going to get this. I bet I'm the only one here that, you know, has state X. I bet I'm the only one here who has got this much resentment. I just hate them all. Metta. Metta. I should be filled with metta. Look at me. Oh, my God. Sometimes I think that our heads should have like a... We could normalize a lot of things if we had like a little, you know, speaker that could run off our thoughts. And we could all just, you know, turn them on some sitting session so we could all listen to each other's thoughts. It would normalize a lot of things. Yes, whatever thought you've had, you're not the only one who's had it here. Even the really weird ones. So we do start to see like our own patterns, and you know, that can be shocking, humiliating, daunting, etc. Yeah, it's just conditioned patterns of thought, emotion, reaction. It's not a big deal. So we see those personal patterns. And then we start to notice something else, too. We start to notice the conditioned and conditional nature of all things and how things arise dependent on causes and conditions, meaning they don't really come out of nowhere, even though you may not be able to see the causes and conditions. And they pass away and change for the same reason, causes and conditions. So what are the causes and conditions? Part of the causes and conditions, which we are actually contributing, have to do with intention that we're bringing and attention, the kind of attention we're bringing to what we experience in real time. Are we bringing wholesome intention to what's being known and mindful attention to what's being known? Because if we are, then we are under the protection of mindfulness. So we're working with the ideal conditions of mind that support the promulgation of wisdom and compassion and renunciation and undercut the suffering states. Doesn't feed them. So once we start to say, okay, experience isn't solid, I don't control what arises from moment to moment, may I meet it with mindfulness and investigation and wisdom. No matter what it is, can I recognize that that's kind of like the task? And then the rest of the practice is like, well, how do you do that? How? With this specific thing that's there, how do you do that? Like, what would be the way to deploy your intention and attention in this particular situation? So over time, in the seeing of the fact that, you know, there's all these different kinds of experiences that come and go, and then there's some that come kind of regularly, you know, the ones that are the butt pain, the ones that come all the time. But now that I'm looking closely and carefully in a more continuous way, I start to understand, well, they're actually impermanent. Have you had any noticing of that thus far? You know, say you walk into a sitting in the morning and you're all bright and cheery and happy. And you sit down, oh, this is great. Then your knee starts to hurt and you go, oh. Then you start to worry, oh God, my knee. And then the mind starts to go, I don't like it. I'm like, this sucks. It's like, this is stupid. Why did I do this? Why am I here? Why am I doing this? Right? I gotta gut it out. I gotta wait till the bell. Well, I could pretend I need to pee. No, I'll gut it out. I don't want to be the one that gets up in the middle of a sitting. Right? So now you're like, ah. You stand up. Stand up, the condition of the body changes, now the knee doesn't hurt anymore. Now the mind goes, oh, okay. Got through that one. Let me go do walking. Ease, ease. Placing. Seeing. Beautiful. So happy to be here. I could be here probably through the end of December. So great. You turn, and you see somebody walk across your walking path, and the mind goes, oh shit, that person again. They are so deluded. You stand there. If you've got mindfulness, you incline the mind to recognize, oh, aversion. Judging. You withdraw your attention from the person crossing your path, and now you're attending to your own experience. Which is the point the whole time. Attending to your own experience in real time and recognizing that it is your own experience, whether it's a sensory experience or an internal experience of thoughts or emotions. Now you're standing there. Aversion. Aversion is like this. Well, I know it's unwholesome. Okay. Now what? Yeah, but he really shouldn't have walked across. Thinking, judging. Let me find the body. Find the feet. Touching. Earth element. Letting go. Relaxing. Breath. Letting go. End of suffering. It's all happening in real time, right? All unfolds in real time. You're just inclining mindfulness to stay with it. Right? The wholesome, the unwholesome, the physical experiences that might arise and be predominant, the emotional experiences that might arise and be predominant, the thinking that might arise and be predominant, the recognition of wholesome and unwholesome, the recognition of pleasant and unpleasant. Just stay current, people. Stay current. Here and now. That's where we're practicing. So once you start to see impermanence, then you start to, it starts to get a little easier. Once you start to see through the truth that, well, you're not really controlling what's happening. The mind gets less mixed up with this idea of feeling that it needs to edit what's happening, and it can kind of rest back a little more and actually be with what's there. And the seeing of impermanence in particular becomes stronger and stronger as the retreat goes on. And that opens the door to be able to see the other two characteristics, which are unsatisfactoriness and not self. So this insight into the fact that you don't have a reliable selector for what you want to have happen, that's actually an insight into not self. And has the implication of unsatisfactoriness, because that means we will experience what is there to be experienced when the causes and conditions for that to happen are present. So we begin to untangle a confusion about how we actually exist, and begin to understand and be able to relate to thought and other things as phenomenon. So in general, you start to come into a more grounded contact with reality, immediate, moment by moment, seeing, and that's the process of ending delusion, the craving that springs from it. Well, how do you end delusion, which the Buddha says is the source of craving that we suffer from? Through increased contact with reality. How do you have increased contact with reality? By learning to see the reality that you're actually experiencing moment to moment, right? So how does the role of a teacher fit into this then? Well, if delusion is the problem because suffering springs from it, trying to see your own delusion is a little bit like trying to see the back of your own head. You know, it's like... So that's where it starts to be... useful to have somebody else that can mirror your experience back to you as you express it and you talk about the adventures that you're having with the sitting, walking, and daily activities. So we listen very carefully to how you describe what you're experiencing. So, you know, there are Dharma talks and there are books and there are podcasts and things like that, but trying to guide your own practice from any of those while you're on retreat usually does not go so well. So there are maps, there are systems of practice, there are talks, there is your own previous experience with practice and other retreats, most of which are not so pertinent right now. Has anybody who's done a good amount of retreat ever found yourself thinking about another retreat that you did and what that was like, and then thinking about or recognizing what this retreat is like, and then trying to figure out why this isn't like that? Now that, I remember that one I had, and you know, it was really pretty smooth. You know, or the other version of that is, I remember that one that I had, and God, it was really hard. It was so difficult. There's just so much stuff coming up. And now, it's pretty smooth. I wonder what's wrong. When's it going to hit? You know, it's kind of like, sometimes people will say things like, so what are you experiencing? Well, it's calm and, you know, the mind is pretty relaxed and it's pretty happy. But I know underneath, it's always there. You know what the Buddha would say? Bullpucky. When it's there, it's there, and when it's not, it's not. Why? Because everything is newly arising due to causes and conditions. Now, what's really there when one is going, but underneath it all, it's always there, is creating a certain kind of story and maybe a kind of worry that some familiar experience may arise. But that's happening in real time, right? That worry that some familiar experience might arise. So, you know, part of the role of the teacher is to hold up this mirror and tell you that's bullpucky or whatever when that's called upon. Say, well, I don't know. Tell me what you're actually experiencing. And to say to you, for instance, well, it sounds like that's not actually there. What's there is a thought, a memory of how it was, and a thought and a fear about a future arising that's happening now, right? That's what's happening now. A memory of something, a thought, and a fear about a future arising. That's your present moment experience. Not the, oh, it's really under there. So, you know, maps can be interesting, but they're, you can't mistake it for the living experience. So we go for the living experience here. That's what we're interested in. Okay. So you're the one who knows your direct experience. If there's mindfulness there and you're attending to it, you know it. How do you know it? Because you're experiencing it. Then you just need to tell us. So the process of awakening is more like a rose or a lotus opening up than a manufacturing process. So you're not like, it's not like a cake recipe or something where, okay, I'm going to dump some mindfulness in this bowl, and then I'm gonna look for some baking soda of investigation and put it in there and add some buttermilk and stir it. Dump some sugar of rapture in there. Smooth it out with a mixer of calm. Yeah. Put it in the oven of continuity. It's more about nurturing wise attention in real time. And when delusion arises and you get swept away, recognizing that's what happened, and then getting yourself back together and getting back on the horse. Oh, that was a weird one. Woo. Oh, that was a 3-hour blip. Hell. It's okay, it's gone. Except the post-dome, you know? It's like, oh, God, I'm so washed out. It's like 3 hours of trying to find the breath and can't do it, and then it's like getting mad, and then getting sad, and then crying, and then getting frustrated, and I'm crying, and then feeling hopeless because I'm crying, and then feeling embarrassed because I'm crying, and feeling mad, and then feeling guilty because I'm in the med hall and you're not supposed to be mad, and it's like then feeling embarrassed because they heard me crying and they're not crying. Well, not yet. You do this very long and you're going to be the one crying sometime. Don't be kidding yourself. You can snivel quietly, but it's coming on you. So you know your own direct experience best. So, but you're not necessarily the best person to interpret it on retreat. Right? So, the image that came to me on this point is it's a little bit like trying to be your own spotter in gymnastics. You know who the spotter is in gymnastics? Like if you're seeing somebody working on like the balance beam or something, there are people kind of like standing around the balance beam and, you know, or the rings, and when, you know, somebody starts flying through the air in a way that they didn't intend, they're the ones that kind of like grab them and it's like, ah. So they don't land real bad. So you can't be your own spotter necessarily, especially if you're in new territory. So we can help you with that. So the role of the teacher in this school of Buddhism, we call it Theravada. It's not exactly Theravada. It's more of a generic early Buddhism blend, but the role of the teacher in this tradition is what's called Kalyanamitta, which means spiritual friend. Right? So we're not like the guru that you need to prostrate yourself to, and you know, you don't need to visualize Jill's image and, you know, do 100,000 prostrations and offer her incense in your imagination. But you could if you wanted to. So, but really, we're here to offer you, we're practitioner teachers who are here to offer you instruction, guidance, and support in the practice of insight meditation and the Brahmaviharas. So that's our role in relationship to that. And we do it by offering meditation instructions, Dharma talks, and individual help in the practice meetings. So let's talk a little bit about the actual practice meetings. So the particular role of the teacher is to help support this process of joint inquiry into what you're experiencing. So that would include like trying to make some kind of contact with you so you feel safe enough and feel respected so you can, you know, be real. To inquire about your specific and current retreat experiences, asking you to describe the particulars you're noticing in your practice. Investigate your investigation. Remember I said you're doing investigation of your experiences in the process of practicing mindfulness meditation, right? You're noticing things. So you come into the practice meeting and you tell us what you're noticing. And then we ask you, for instance, about it. Tell me more. We love a good hindrance story. So, a big part of what we do is to guide you to talk about and hold your experiences within the teaching framework. So you might come and say, you know, you really need to serve coffee here. How can we get some? Spirit Rock has it. And we'll say, they have a bigger budget. No. We'll say, oh, there's some wanting there, huh? When did you notice that? How did that come up for you? And when that came up like that, did you note it as wanting? And then as you noticed that, when that was there strongly as your predominant experience, then what happened? What happened next? Where was it? Was it in your body? Or was it in your mind? Did it come up as like memories? Did it come up as fantasies? Did it come up as a internally generated smell of some nice, well, dark roast? What was it? Huh? So we're supporting you in developing the capacity to notice your experience in real time by asking you particulars. So another thing we can offer is clarification about the meditation instructions and modifications to them based on what you tell us is happening when you use a particular approach. Now, if somebody says, well, I was working with pain in the body like this, but it just got, you know, worse and worse, and then it got unbearable, and then the only thing that I could do was just like, you know, chew on my meditation shawl until the bell rang. The teacher would probably say something like, well, you stayed with it too long. You can move. You don't need to stay there and be with it like that. So always a question about, is the mindfulness strong enough to meet the experience that's happening? Because sustaining mindfulness is the most important piece. So sometimes mindfulness can't hold what's happening in the way it's being displayed. So then what? So then one needs to attend to something else in a way that where mindfulness can be sustained. Right? So we can help you troubleshoot places in practice where you're having difficulty and give you tips and give you advice on what is skillful effort. But we have this idea, you know, that the most important axis for effort is like hard or strong, or weak and limp. Well, that's one potential axis for describing wise effort. But sometimes what wise effort is in a certain situation could be very soft and very yielding. It could involve turning away from a confrontation with a particular immediate experience and going to some other practice like metta, or not even trying to directly practice with what's happening, but, you know, going and taking a shower just to open up some space around the mind in support of mindfulness of sati being there. So the practice instructions are kind of like the basic rules for how to go about establishing mindfulness and what to attend to. But this is an art. So another thing we can help you with is to help keep you from deluded self-evaluation, right? To clarify your Dharma questions and to point out to you the Dharma insights that are actually arising in practice. And just to generically encourage you. So your role in this is you need to be a full participant in this, right? So you provide the information that we need in order to have this dialogue by telling us what you are noticing in your practice. So then there can be questions from the teacher that elicits more from you that helps us understand what's going on. So if you can have at least provisional trust in the teachers that you're meeting with, that's very helpful, because then you can be forthright in what you're speaking. And, you know, we get that nervousness and vulnerability and, you know, fear and all that, you know, can be part of this, especially at certain times. You know, when you're in a silent mode and it can seem weird to talk, period, let alone to, you know, come into a room with somebody like you hardly know and then tell them this thing that's happening that seems like, oh, maybe this shouldn't be happening, or I'm really bad at this, or this is weird, or whatever. you know, but if you can get over your fear of that, of being judged, or, you know, over the need to feel like you're doing it really good and have it under control, we can really talk. So even if it's just you saying, you know, I feel like afraid to say what's going on, or I feel kind of embarrassed right now, or I'm not sure how to start this, or whatever, just get something going. Just get something out there, you know, and we'll see what we can do to pick up the thread and support you in expressing it. So, you know, if you can be authentic and forthright, it's very helpful. And if you're nervous, you can just say that and we'll, like, help get you going. So if possible, if you can report your experience within the framework of the practice instructions, it would be good. Like, I sat down, I, you know, turned mindfulness towards the sensation of the breath. You know, I was with the breath at the abdomen for a while, and then all these thoughts started coming up, and, you know, I tried to get back to the breath, but, you know, I couldn't. Every time I did it, then it just, you know, went off somewhere else, and, you know, I just got really frustrated, and then I thought, oh, I'm really bad at this, and, right? So the teacher would go through, okay, present with the breath, and then the mind... thoughts arose in the mind. Did they have a theme? You know, were they a particular kind of thought? Were they pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant? How did the mind react when it realized it was thinking and couldn't get back to the breath? Was it frustrated? Was it like, I don't know why, not sure why it's happening? Right? We can help you, like, get in there and look more closely at what the experience actually was. in the interest of heightening mindfulness in relationship to it and in relationship to other experiences that you will have. In other words, we can help you learn how to investigate. So an important thing to know is that you're not going to shock us. Okay? We've watched our own minds, okay? You probably don't have any new ones. So you can bring anything into the room, and I'd invite you to do it. And, you know, don't try to conceal things. In some ways, this is like a therapy session in that very often people will save the most important thing till the end. And as they're walking out the door, then they'll say, "And I haven't slept for 4 days, you know, or one of these." Okay, so, you know, if there's like a major thing that's going on, you know, that would probably be a little more significant to bring forward and to talk about than, you know, some other things like feeling resentment because, you know, they don't have coffee or something. So you can be real. You know, cover something from sitting, walking, and your daily activities. So if you want to know how we decide what to advise you, here's the secret formula. It's what you tell us, verbally and non-verbally, plus the teacher's Dharma knowledge, meditation experience mixed with intuition and what arises in the moment. That's the advice and guidance you're going to get. So none of us are looking to impose a fixed template on you. Right? We're really listening closely to what you tell us. And often, you know, asking questions back about, well, and then what happened? So this is our joint product, our joint investigation, our joint Dhamma Vihara. And it's dependent on what's arising for both the yogi and the teacher. So we would wish you participate fully in developing your own path to awakening through these means and through this support. So let's just sit for 1 minute. May our practice be for our own benefit and for that of all beings.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.